I would like to welcome everyone to our third call in our introduction to Epilepsy Audio Call Series. My name is Sean Gamble, and I am with the Employee Education Services here in St. Louis, and I'm the project manager for this series of calls. This is a call that will continue to occur every other month on the first Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Our next call will be on September 7th with Dr. Jose Caveros. Our lines are muted and will be opened at the end of the presentation when we are ready for questions and answers. Please limit your questions to one per person. Please be sure to complete your evaluation to get credit for this program. Complete directions can be found in the brochure or on the catalog online. You will have 30 days to submit your evaluation forms. Deadline date is August 8th. Now I'd like to welcome our speaker for today, Dr. Martin Selinsky. Dr. Selinsky, it's all yours.
Hi, this is Marty Selinsky from the Portland VA Epilepsy Center of Excellence. I'd like to welcome you all to this conference on psychogenic seizures. We have a crowded agenda today, so I'm going to start right in. I would ask you all, if you're following along with the slides, to view this in normal mode rather than in slide mode. That little button at the bottom of your screen, there are some builds that I inadvertently left in these slides. And if you view this in normal mode, you won't have to do multiple taps to get all of the elements of each screen up. Okay, if you'll go to slide number 2, you'd better ask the doctors here about my illness, sir. Ask them whether my fit was real or not. From the Brothers Karamazov, Fyodor Dostoevsky, in 1881. And now, 130 years later, neurologists are still frequently asked to tell whether the fit was real or not. So our topic today is, in my opinion, one of the most fascinating types of seizures and one of the least understood, the psychogenic seizures. And this is a seizure type that I think all VA providers need to be familiar with. Next slide is slide number 3. We'll talk about three topics today. First, an overview of psychogenic seizures. Then I'll spend a few minutes talking about some new research on the problem of psychogenic seizures in veterans. Hello? And finally, as time allows, we'll spend a few minutes talking about treatment and prognosis. Slide 4. It's worth saying a few words about epilepsy as we begin. Epilepsy is the most common problem faced by neurologists in the world. The prevalence of epilepsy in the world is well over 1%, more than 1 in every 100 people, and the U.S. prevalence is pretty close to 1%, a little bit higher in veterans. And as you can imagine, any disorder that's this common is going to have a tremendous impact on global health and is going to be enormously expensive. And any subgroup of this population is going to be an important medical problem in and of itself. And of course, not everyone diagnosed with epilepsy is going to turn out to have epilepsy. And on slide 5, I've listed several disorders that can mimic the appearance of epileptic seizures and are confused with epilepsy in adults. Some of these are more common than others. Syncope, cardiovascular events, are obviously going to be more common than sleep disorders and migraine and movement disorders as far as being confused with epileptic seizures. But by far, the most common disorders that mimic epilepsy in the adult population are psychological disorders, and particularly what we term the psychogenic seizures. That's our topic for today. If you go to slide 6, I have a couple of definitions written out. A non-epileptic seizure is an alteration in behavior that resembles an epileptic seizure, but it is not caused by paroxysmal neuronal discharges, the root cause of epileptic seizures. And psychogenic seizures are a subcategory of non-epileptic seizure, in which there is no other physiologic abnormality to explain the episode, and in which there is a probable psychological origin to the episode. This same information is presented in chart form in slide number 7. you can see that the seizures can be broken down into epileptic seizures, and that's a topic for a different day, and non-epileptic seizures, these seizure lookalikes. And then we can break the non-epileptic seizures down into those of physiologic origin, and there's a differential diagnosis there. Think of the hypoglycemia, so on. And non-epileptic seizures of psychogenic origin. And again, there's a differential diagnosis here, malingering or somatoform disorder, dissociative disorder, and so on. It's of some interest to our discussion today that in an adult population with non-epileptic seizures, roughly 90% will be shown to have a psychogenic origin and only 10% will have a physiologic origin. It's also important to note that many, if not most of these patients, will fit into the category of having medically refractory seizures. That is, seizures that have not responded to multiple trials of conventional anti-epileptic drug therapy. And I mention this because this group of patients with medically refractory seizures is, in general, the most disabled group of epilepsy patients, and they're also the most expensive group to treat. The next slide, slide number 8, shows the frequency of psychogenic seizures from several inpatient video EEG studies. I've listed these, I think, in chronological order, including a series we did here at the Portland VA Medical Center. And what you can see is that somewhere between 20 and 50% of patients who come into an epilepsy monitoring unit for video EEG evaluation will exit with the diagnosis of psychogenic seizures. So please, these events are very common. Slide number 9 shows an outpatient prevalence estimate for psychogenic seizures, and obviously this is an estimate. We really don't know how many outpatients with epilepsy have psychogenic seizures, but at least a couple of these estimates are, I think, fairly reliable. And it looks like 4 to 5% of epilepsy outpatients actually have psychogenic seizures. Now, because these patients tend to fall into the category of medically refractory seizures, it turns out that 10 to 20% of patients with medically refractory epilepsy will have psychogenic seizures. That's a fairly sizable group. On slide 10, I've listed some observations that can be helpful if you're fortunate enough to view one of these seizures and you're trying to figure out whether it's psychogenic or not. At this point in the talk, I would usually show you some videos to help you recognize these seizures, but that's not going to be possible today. When you're dealing with convulsive seizures, the most important thing to look for are the body movements. Way the pattern of body movement progresses. And on slide 11, I've given a couple of important examples. In epileptic seizures, the jerking phase or the clonic activity is in phase. The arms and the legs move together, left and right moves together. But in the non-epileptic or psychogenic variety, the movements are often thrashing and very much out of phase or even bicycling on occasion. In the epileptic seizure, during the rigid phase or the tonic phase, patients will sometimes have arching of the back called opisthotonus, but you will not see this phenomena called pelvic thrusting, a repetitive thrusting about the waist, which for some reason is peculiar to these psychogenic seizures. And if you go to slide 12, you'll see a drawing of a patient at the end of one of these episodes of pelvic thrusting adopting this rather extreme posture, which we still see in patients to this day, named the Arc de Cercle by Charcot and his colleagues in the late 1800s. This is a plate from a book called The Iconographie Photographique, which has been reprinted, and I would recommend to you. It's really a fascinating series of photographs and drawings of patients who were being treated for hysteria in France in the late 1800s. And on the next slide, I have a picture of Charcot himself, the famous master who really put this disorder on the map under the name of hysteroepilepsy in the late 1800s. Next slide. This is a plate from an article in the British Medical Journal in 1878 by one Arthur Gamgee, M.D., who is charged with recording the demonstrations given by Professor Charcot in his laboratory in Paris, where many famous physicians of the day came to study. And in this article, he says, hysteroepilepsy is a nervous disorder of women of great rarity, affecting them especially during the childbearing period of life, associated with hyperesthesia of one or both ovarian regions. And this was the thought of the day. Now, as it turns out, Charcot had the whole thing wrong. Charcot thought epilepsy was a psychological disorder, and he thought hysteroepilepsy was a combination of the two psychological disorders, epilepsy and hysteria. And on the next slide, you'll see a picture of one of Charcot's students, Joseph Babinski, the man who invented the Babinski tocine or the Babinski reflex. And his student Babinski, several years later, set Charcot right by informing him that most of the patients he diagnosed with hysteroepilepsy had no spontaneous attacks. They were only having attacks when Charcot would hypnotize them and suggest that they have an attack. And if you read the original descriptions of Charcot's patients, that's exactly what he did.
Sure, they want you to run everything.
Next slide. It was another one of Charcot's students, Sigmund Freud, who chimed in on this topic a bit later. You remember that I opened up with a quote from Fyodor Dostoevsky and the brothers Karamazov. I've reproduced that quote at the bottom of the page. And in 1928, in a now very famous article called Dostoevsky and Parasite, Freud opined that Dostoevsky himself suffered from hysteroepilepsy, and this was caused by a latent desire to murder his own father. Those were the good old days. Next slide, we're now up to slide 17. Other observations that might be helpful if you happen to see one of these seizures, and I would like to point out one of my favorites, which is the duration of the attack. On slide 18, you'll see a chart that we made up many years ago, and we actually did this experiment for a completely different reason, and it shows the length of several seizures that we recorded in our epilepsy monitoring unit. And in the yellow are the epileptic seizures. You can see that epileptic seizures generally last for a minute, maybe 2 or 3 minutes tops. Occasionally, you can see one a bit longer. But these psychogenic seizures have a much more variable pattern, and it is not uncommon to see them last 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, or even 2 or 3 hours at a time. So if you happen to see a seizure or hear of a seizure that lasted an extremely long time, the antennas should go up, and you should at least consider the possibility that this might not have been an epileptic seizure. It might have been a psychogenic seizure. Slide 19. The diagnosis of psychogenic seizures rests on a laboratory evaluation, and in this case, the laboratory evaluation is electroencephalography, or EEG. But in order to make the diagnosis, it has to be an ictal EEG, an EEG recorded while the patient is actually having the event, not in between events. There are a couple of reasons for this, and I've outlined these reasons on slide 20. First of all, about 30% of patients who have real epilepsy will have no interictal discharges, even if you do multiple. normal intraacral EEGs cannot be used to rule out epilepsy. Secondly, there are many people who do not have epilepsy who have intraictal epileptiform discharges in their EEG. It's a nonspecific finding. So an epileptiform intraictal EEG cannot be used to diagnose epilepsy, and it certainly cannot be used to rule out non-epileptic or psychogenic seizures. Thirdly, next slide, there are many patients who have both psychogenic seizures and epileptic seizures, and this is a situation you can't hope to possibly tease apart unless you have an ictal recording of both types of spells. I've listed six series here that looked at the rate of having both psychogenic seizures and epileptic seizures. Depending on the study, this ranges anywhere from 5 to as high as 30%. Slide 22. So it is the ictal EEG that is the diagnostic modality for psychogenic non-epileptic seizures, and in order to do ictal EEG, we have to admit patients to the hospital, to an epilepsy monitoring unit, and perform continuous inpatient video EEG monitoring. And since we have the patient in the hospital, we like to do a comprehensive evaluation, which includes not only a neurological evaluation, but a psychiatric evaluation and a neuropsychological evaluation. This gives us the most complete picture of these often very complex patients. Please skip the next two slides and go on to slide 25. This pie chart on slide 25 is a series of 58 patients that we studied here at the Portland VA Hospital. They were studied by Susan Smith, psychiatrist that we were working with at the time. And for each patient, she selected one primary Axis I psychiatric diagnosis from DSM-3. And this pie chart shows you the results, and as you can see, a majority of patients diagnosed with psychogenic seizures were diagnosed with somatoform or conversion disorders, more than 50%. There is a fair representation of patients with dissociative disorders, and I would point out that both the somatoform disorders and dissociative disorders assume that the motivation for having these seizures is subconscious, that the patients are not aware that these seizures are not real. Malingering is represented here as well, but it's not as common as most people think. In our series, we only found evidence for this in 8% of patients, and in most series, it's less than 10%. And factitious disorder, another 6%. Malingering and factitious disorder are important diagnoses because it is assumed in these cases that the patients are actually faking the seizures. They're conscious of what they're doing for either financial gain or some other type of gain. On slide 26, I've listed some of the results from, I think, the best psychiatric study done on patients with psychogenic seizures. This was a study done by Elizabeth Bowman in 1996. And I just want to emphasize to you that psychogenic seizures should be considered as a symptom of underlying psychiatric disease. They're really not a disease state in and of themselves. They're a symptom. And understanding the underlying psychiatric problems is ultimately the key to successful treatment. Anyway, in this study, Dr. Bowman looked at 45 patients, and I'll point out that 35 of the 45 were women, and much as Charcot surmised back in the 1800s, most patients, about 75%, who are diagnosed with psychogenic seizures in the civilian population are women, and it's a disease largely of younger women. All of these patients patients were diagnosed with psychogenic seizures by video EEG monitoring, and Dr. Bowman examined these patients using the SCID, which is a structured clinical interview for DSM, in this case DSM-3, and is a sort of gold standard for doing objective psychiatric evaluations. A couple of historical things to point out here. First of all, there was a history of physical or sexual abuse in childhood in a great majority of the women in this study, and several other studies have reproduced this finding. Secondly, nearly half of the patients in the study had a history of substance abuse, and that again is a common finding in psychiatric studies of psychogenic seizures. Slide 27 lists the AXIS 1 and AXIS 2 diagnoses made by Dr. Bowman, and in this study she allowed multiple AXIS 1 diagnoses. And once again, as in Dr. Smith's study, the most common diagnoses were somatoform and conversion disorders, dissociative disorders in this case in 91%. But many AXIS 1 diagnoses are represented, affective disorders in a majority of patients, other anxiety disorders in nearly half of the patients, and personality disorders, AXIS 2, came in more than 60% of patients. In this study, the mean number of current AXIS 1 diagnoses at the time of the diagnosis of psychogenic seizures was 4.4, and I bring this up to point out that at the time that these patients were diagnosed, they came in with a heavy load of psychiatric diagnoses. And again, I think this is a tip-off for all of us when you see patients with seizure disorders who are carrying a heavy load of psychiatric diagnoses, the antennas should go up to alert you to the possibility of psychogenic non-epileptic seizures. The final point on this slide is that nearly half of the patients in this study had PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's something that we'll be interested in when we discuss psychogenic seizures in veterans here in a moment. And we can move on now to slide 29, the impact of the epilepsy diagnosis. And I want to point out something which I hope is obvious to you. Patients with psychogenic seizures are just as disabled as patients with epilepsy. And in fact, they are just as disabled as patients who have medically refractory epilepsy, the most disabled group in the epilepsy population. They suffer from the same restrictions on driving, and working, and other activities. There is the social stigma associated with having epilepsy and the psychological problems that come along with that. And there is the considerable cost of the assessments and treatments. If you go to the next slide, I have a cost estimate at the bottom. For 2010, it's estimated that psychogenic seizures will cost the United States somewhere between $2.3 and $4.8 billion. Epilepsy is a very expensive disorder. Medically refractory epilepsy, extremely expensive, and patients with psychogenic seizures tend to mimic the costs of patients with medically refractory epilepsy. Next slide, slide 31. I would also point out that patients with psychogenic seizures can suffer the medical complications of therapy, and particularly anti-epileptic drug therapy. On slide 32, I've shown the results of a couple of studies that we've done on our patients at the Oregon Health Sciences University, our affiliated university hospital, one series in 1994 and another in 2005, in which we simply looked at how many anti-epileptic drugs patients were taking at the time that they were admitted to the epilepsy monitoring unit and diagnosed with psychogenic seizures. As you can see, in both series, about 90% of patients were taking anti-epileptic drugs, and many of them were taking more than one anti-epileptic drug. epileptic drug. And as you know, these drugs all have side effects and there are potential complications. We've also had many patients admitted to the intensive care units in psychogenic status epilepticus. Several of these patients were intubated. They were stuck with all sorts of lines and given all sorts of drugs with the expected complications. So this disorder is not benign. Next slide. I'd now like to turn to our second topic, which is psychogenic seizures in veterans. And we became interested in this because of the widespread feeling that somehow psychogenic seizures are more common in veterans than they are in civilians. And this has really not been looked at very carefully. There's actually only one paper in the literature on psychogenic seizures in veterans, and that paper written a number of years ago, and a relatively small group of patients. So we decided to do a chart review and look at some of our patients with psychogenic seizures. And before we get to that, I just need to make one or two quick points about the relationship between traumatic brain injury and epilepsy. Next slide, slide 34, if you've just joined us. Traumatic brain injury is the most common cause of new onset epilepsy in young adults. I think most of you know that. And there's an even higher risk if it is a military combat traumatic brain injury. A recent report from the Vietnam Head Injury Study pegs this at 45%. It's an incredibly high number. This may be due to the relatively high rate of penetrating head injuries in combat. These penetrating head injuries have a very high risk of development of epilepsy. Slide 35. What's less well known is that there is also this sort of funny relationship between traumatic brain injury and the development of psychogenic seizures. There are two studies on this that I've quoted on this slide. And in both of these studies, the authors looked at a group of patients with psychogenic seizures at the time that they were diagnosed and asked them what caused the seizures. And in both studies, the most common single response was that the seizures were caused by a traumatic brain injury. And these are civilian studies. Most of these traumatic brain injuries were what would be called either minor or mild, and we now have reason to believe that head injuries of this severity are not associated with an increased risk of seizures. But of course, the patients don't know that. They start developing spells and they blame it on some trauma that they've had. The psychologists tell me the name for this is a permissive event. The traumatic brain injury is a permissive event, and later, under psychological stress, patients develop psychogenic seizures, feeling that the traumatic brain injury was what made them more susceptible to developing seizures. Slide 36. There are reasons to believe that veterans are at an increased risk for the development of psychogenic seizures. First is the relatively high rates of traumatic brain injury, and we've just discussed that. And to some extent, related to this are the relatively high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder, recently estimated to be about 20% in the OEF-OIF veterans. And as I mentioned earlier, post-traumatic stress disorder is an established risk factor for the development of psychogenic seizures. The third point on this slide is one we don't usually like to talk about. It's the issue of compensation. And it is a fact that in the VA medical system, patients can extract some financial gain from having a chronic illness that's related to their service in the military. And even though malingering and factitious disorder are not common in series of patients with psychogenic seizures, they do occur, and it is another potential risk factor for veterans. Slide 37. So we set out to learn learn something about the issue of psychogenic seizures in veterans. And there are three questions we wanted to answer in the study that I'll show you in a moment. First, are psychogenic seizures more common in veterans than in civilians, at least those who I heard for video EEG monitoring? Second, is there a longer delay between the onset of the illness to diagnosis in veterans as compared to civilians? And thirdly, it's been our impression that veterans with psychogenic seizures are on more anti-epileptic drugs than civilians who have psychogenic seizures, so we wanted to look at that as well. Slide 38. To look at this problem, we took advantage of sort of a natural experiment that occurred between the years 2000 and 2010. Our epilepsy monitoring unit at the Portland VA was shared by patients from the Portland VA and by civilians from our affiliate, the Oregon Health Sciences University. And all of these patients were evaluated in the same epilepsy monitoring unit by the same doctors and nurses using the same equipment and using the same treatment protocol. So it was fairly easy to tee up a comparison between these two groups. On slide 39, I have two pie charts showing the results of this study, and you're looking now at the discharge diagnoses in well over 900 patients. We start out on the left. I would point out that 25% of veterans were discharged with a diagnosis of psychogenic non-epileptic seizures. If we compare that to discharges in the civilian patient, it's virtually identical, 26%. So as a raw number, the percentage of veterans and civilians who are discharged with a diagnosis of psychogenic seizures is virtually identical. However, it seems like the veterans have a higher rate of psychogenic seizures because the rate of epileptic seizures is relatively low. And in fact, the rate of epileptic seizures as a diagnosis was only 18%. It was less than the rate of diagnosis of psychogenic seizures. My colleagues at other VA epilepsy units tell me they have very similar results. Whereas in the civilian population, a much larger group of patients, 40%, are diagnosed with epileptic seizures, and the group with psychogenic seizures is relatively small. So if you sort of look at this as a ratio of diagnostic studies, the percentage of patients who have psychogenic seizures and are diagnosed, that is, reach a diagnosis within the veteran group, is much higher than within the civilian groups and gives the appearance that psychogenic seizures are more common in veterans. Next slide, slide 40, gets to the comparison that we really wanted to do. And we were able to find 50 veterans in our series who had psychogenic seizures, that 25% that I just mentioned to you. And we did a comparison to 50 civilian patients who were diagnosed with psychogenic seizures. These were the next consecutive civilians in our database. On the second line, you'll see that veterans were older at the time that they were admitted for evaluation, and that most of the veterans were male, whereas most of the civilians were female. This is just as you would expect. Most of these patients were using anti-epileptic drugs at the time they were admitted, somewhere between 1 and 3 anti-epileptic drugs, again, as we would expect. If you look at the bottom line here, this is where it gets interesting. We looked at the time interval from the onset of these psychogenic seizures to the time that the patients were admitted for their diagnostic epilepsy monitoring unit admission. And for civilians, it was about 1 year, and for veterans, it was about 5 years. It's about a fivefold difference. So for some reason, veterans are coming to diagnosis after a much longer interval than civilians. And this is reflected in the cumulative years of anti-epileptic drug use, which is 1 year for civilians and 4 years for veterans, again, because of the delay in diagnosis. On slide 41, we've graphed out these time intervals from onset to diagnostic admission. And you can see toward the right-hand side of this slide that the delay is largely due to veterans who had psychogenic seizures for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and in one case, nearly 30 years before they were diagnosed. We reviewed the charts of all of these veterans, and all of these veterans who had long-term psychogenic seizures were under chronic treatment with anti-epileptic drugs for medically refractory epilepsy. On slide 42, why the delay in diagnosis in veterans? Well, of course, we don't know. It may simply be due to a lack of availability of epilepsy monitoring units in the VA medical system. About half of our patients came from states where there were no VA epilepsy monitoring units, and this creates some disincentive for sending patients out to be diagnosed.
Oh, tell her to go.
Hopefully, this has been at least partially addressed with the creation of the VA Epilepsy Centers of Excellence. The other possibility is that there may be some acceptance of seizures within the VA medical system, particularly amongst primary providers, because of the known relationship between traumatic brain injury and epilepsy. A patient who has a history of traumatic brain injury presents with seizure-like spells, and it's not questioned because seizures are a common complication of traumatic brain injury. We have some data supporting this. If you look at slide 43, we asked, or we rather checked in the charts of our patients, some we asked, some we just reviewed charts for, to find out what these patients thought was the etiology of what turned out to be psychogenic seizures. They didn't know it at the time. And among civilian patients, about 25-26% of patients thought that their seizures were caused by a traumatic brain injury. This is virtually identical to the information I showed you a bit earlier. But in the veteran patients, nearly 60% of patients thought that the seizures were related to a previous traumatic brain injury. So it turns out that many of these patients believe that traumatic brain injury, mostly traumatic brain injuries in the military, were the root cause of their seizures. We'll move on now to slide 44. It outlines questions remaining, and of course there are many questions remaining, but none are more important than the first one. What are the psychiatric disorders underlying the development of psychogenic seizures in veterans? And we have really no information on this, and it's absolutely critical that we obtain this information because that is the information that will eventually dictate the therapeutic approaches that can be used. I'd like you to skip the next couple of slides and move on to slide 47, and in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I'd just like to say a few words about the treatment of psychogenic seizures and the prognosis. Slide 48 outlines the initial conventional therapy for psychogenic seizures. This is what we do in the monitoring unit at the time that we make the diagnosis. Honest, supportive, conclusive presentation of the diagnosis. We let patients know exactly what's going on in a supportive way. We have good news for you. You do not have epilepsy. Here's what's happening. And we try and explain the nature of psychogenic seizures. This varies a bit depending on the patient and what we believe the underlying psychiatric problems are, but we like to go through this carefully. We discontinue anti-epileptic drugs unless they're being used for another problem, such as treatment for pain or some other psychiatric disorder. And we always make referral to mental health. Usually, this referral is for supportive counseling, but sometimes it's for other modalities that we'll discuss here in a moment. The results of this type of treatment are not entirely satisfactory. Many patients continue to have seizures, and so over the years, various other treatments have been tried in an attempt to more specifically get at the root cause of these psychogenic seizures. And if we go to slide 49, you'll see one such treatment. This is the Bart Simpson treatment. I have not personally tried this treatment, but I suspect it may work as well as some of the other treatments that I have tried. On slide 50, I've listed the various treatments that have been used in patients with psychogenic seizures. In the old days, psychotherapy was very common. Nowadays, cognitive behavioral therapy is more common. Medications have been used, particularly antidepressants, if the patients were depressed, and a variety of other, sometimes alternative therapies, relaxation therapy, biofeedback, meditation, EMDR. But as of 2006, when both a Cochrane review and an NIH treatment workshop were convened, there were no validated treatments or controlled trials. There's really nothing to base your treatment decision on because there were no good randomized double-blind trials of any of these therapies. Slide 51 shows a study that was published just last year, and it is, for my money, the best treatment study ever done on patients with psychogenic seizures. It is a randomized blinded trial of cognitive behavioral therapy versus standard supportive counseling. The study was done by Goldstein et al. At the Maudsley Hospital in London. And this is a good news, bad news study. The good news is that it was very well conducted, I think really sets a new standard. And at the end of 3 months of cognitive behavioral therapy, you can see that these patients clearly did better with lower seizure frequency than patients who received standard medical care. The bad news is that if you look out at the six-month follow-up, the curves start to move together and the results are no longer statistically significant. Next slide. The other piece of bad news is that even at the end of treatment, there was no difference in the number of patients who became completely seizure-free, the number of ER visits, the number of outpatient clinic visits, and other medical indicators. So the good news, cognitive behavioral therapy seems to have some positive effect. The bad news, the effect doesn't seem to outlast the treatment very well, and based on other indicators, the effect is not particularly strong. Still, I view this study as a step in the right direction. Slide 53 shows the results of six studies which looked at the outcome of patients with psychogenic non-epileptic seizures. These studies varied in time interval and in the protocols they used, but I just wanted to make a couple of points. The first point is it's not all bad news. Just with diagnosis and conventional therapy, somewhere between 30 and 50% of these patients will stop having seizures. They will become seizure-free within an interval of 6 months to about 4 years. And also good news, a majority of these patients will be off of anti-epileptic drugs over the same interval. Several of these studies showed that a shorter duration of illness at diagnosis correlated with a better outcome, not all the studies, but several. And again, I point out that finding we have with veteran patients that the interval to diagnosis is much longer than it is in with civilian patients. So we may have some work to do there if we want to see better outcomes in our veteran patients. The largest of these studies is the McKenzie study from 2010, which is shown on the next slide, slide 54. And I just put this study up because, again, it has some good news, and it was a fairly large study. If you look toward the bottom of this chart, The percentage of patients using anti-epileptic drugs went from 52 to 13%. The percent of patients who were employed went from 10 to 23%. And up at the top, at the 6 to 12 month follow-up interval, 38% of these patients were free of the seizures. So just with diagnosis and conventional therapy, many patients do well. Not as many as we'd like, but many patients do well. These authors also looked at factors that were associated with a seizure-free outcome, and I point out that patients who had no prior history of depression or anxiety tended to do better. And this is an old finding. It's been seen in other studies as well. If you'll go to the next slide, Andy Kanner's study from 1999 is shown, and this study, very nicely done study, showed that there was a worse outcome in patients with a history of major depression, personality disorders, and dissociative disorders. In other words, patients who have a heavy psychiatric burden at the time of diagnosis do not do as well as patients with a lesser psychiatric burden. I think that's a point that should be fairly obvious. Well, my time is just about up, so I'd like to skip down to the summary slide, which is slide 60. And three points I'd like to emphasize. First, psychogenic seizures are common. They probably represent 10 to 20% of all patients who have medically refractory seizures. Some indication that they may even represent a higher percentage within the VA medical system. Second, that psychogenic seizures are symptoms of psychiatric disorders. This is both a clue to the early recognition of patients with psychogenic seizures and ultimately an opportunity for intervention. And the third point, treatment of this disorder remains problematic. I really think that we're in our infancy when it comes to the treatment of psychogenic seizures. But diagnosis alone, combined with conventional supportive counseling, will often lead to improvement, and early diagnosis can certainly decrease the accumulated disability associated with this disorder, and it may improve the long-term outcome. Ultimately, the treatment will have to be based on the underlying psychiatric disorders, and this is a topic that, at least for veterans, we currently know very little about. I'd like to thank you for attending the conference call today, and I would be very happy to answer any questions.
Is there any questions? Or is everybody still muted?
Sounds like everybody's still muted.
All right, I'm trying to get a hold of the operator to get everybody unmuted.
Okay.
Everybody should be unmuted now.
This is Roy Cantor. I'm in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Hey, Roy. How are you?
Fine. How are you, Marty?
I'm good. Thanks. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah. So this was a great overview, and I thank you for that. I think I spoke to you over a year ago and said I really need to hear a program on psychogenic non-epileptic seizures, and I do appreciate it. One of my problems is trying to deal with the primary care docs and the emergency room doctors who, when a patient comes in with one of their attacks, automatically puts these folks back on their anti-epileptic medications after we've worked pretty hard to get them off. Do you have an approach that you use for that?
That's a great question. I think it's a very common problem. We have it not only in our VA clinics, but in our civilian clinics as well. I do not have an approach to this other than frequent visits to the emergency room to emphasize to the physicians there to please contact the neurologist before they restart anti-epileptic drugs in patients who are known to the system. That being said, I think my success rate with this is less than 50%. And the other problem, of course, is that patients with psychogenic seizures are notorious for visiting multiple different emergency rooms. So whereas patients who came to your emergency room, the physician might look up in CPRS and see that the patient's under treatment and call you or call another doctor who's been involved in their care. If that patient goes cross town to another hospital where they don't have access to the records, the doctors are much more likely to shoot from the hip. It's a common problem. Everybody complains about it. I don't know the answer to this problem.
All right, thank you.
Hi, my name is Josie, and I am from the Durham VA Medical Center.
Hi, Josie.
We're one of the epilepsy centers of excellence. And my question is, a patient has been given the diagnosis of non-epileptic seizures. What type of follow-up do these patients have once they're given that diagnosis?
That's a good question, and the answer is it depends. For patients that we see here at the Portland VA, we will usually follow them initially in the epilepsy clinic, really just to make sure that we've established care. But then we turn over care to primary care and to mental health. The role of neurology in ongoing care is somewhat questionable. Many of our patients wind up coming from other states or other parts of Oregon, and follow-up in Portland is impractical, so they get their follow-up care through their primary care physicians or their neurologists in the locale that they were referred from. The important thing, I think, is to make sure that all of the care providers know the diagnosis, that they've received a letter going over the diagnosis, how the diagnosis was established, and that the referring providers have a care plan in hand. They know that these psychogenic seizures should not be treated with anti-epileptic drugs, that the main treatment is through mental health. And if there are recurring questions about whether epileptic seizures have started up, they should be referred back, probably for further video EEG monitoring. And I point out that it's not uncommon for patients who are diagnosed with psychogenic seizures to wind up coming back to our clinics or our monitoring unit 3 years or 5 years or 10 years later because the physician has noticed a change in the seizures and they're now wondering whether there are epileptic seizures as well. And I think that's a fair question. And when faced with that question, the best thing to do is to readmit the patient for further video EEG monitoring.
Okay. Do you have, once the patient is given that diagnosis, during that admission, before they are discharged, do you have, a nursing educator, say, in the epilepsy center, that explains to the patient, to help them understand or to kind of explore maybe things that have happened, trauma that may have occurred, to help explain the diagnosis of non-epileptic seizures?
We do that. I think I had mentioned that a little bit earlier on in the talk, but the standard procedure at the time of discharge is for the physician, be myself or one of the other epileptologists we have here in Portland, to have a detailed discharge conference with the patient and any family members that they want involved, explaining the nature of their illness, and in some cases trying to go into some detail about the nature of, for example, a conversion disorder and what that means. So we try and spend quite a bit of time going over this and
yeah,
making sure
could,
that the patient make sure that the patient understands.
We don't
have a nurse practitioner who does this. We do have a nurse practitioner here, but that duty falls on the physician who has done the EMU evaluation. I think it's absolutely critical that this type of discharge conference takes place.
Yeah, you're sending.
Patients who leave the epilepsy monitoring unit and don't understand the nature of their diagnosis are, I think, doomed to failure. They're certainly going to continue to have spells.
Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Kirsten at Little Rock. I just have a question for Sean right quick. On the brochure that came with the course, it says the deadline is June 4th to submit your eval form. That's not correct, obviously. What is the deadline?
It is August 8th.
Thank you.
Yep.
I have one further question. What percentage of patients with non-epileptic seizures also turn out to have epileptic seizures?
There are at least six major studies of this, Roy, and the percentage varies depending on who you read. It's somewhere between 5% and 30%. The lower estimates are probably more correct. I would say it's probably around 10%. The higher estimates are patients who were shown to have psychogenic seizures but also had interictal epileptiform discharges. And as you know, the presence of interictal epileptiform discharges doesn't necessarily mean that the patient was also having epileptic seizures. So it's probably about 10%.
All right, thank you.
Yep.
Dr. Slinsky?
Yes.
This is Mark Testa from the Baltimore VA. In my experience, I've seen men with psychogenic seizures. They seem to maybe be more self-injurious or display different behaviors during their episodes than women. Have you experienced that? Have you noticed any differences in the semiology of psychogenic seizures between men and women?
Yes, we have. I think they're different. And there have actually been a couple of articles written about this, about the differences between men and women, and also about the differences in the psychiatric profiles of men and women with psychogenic seizures. For example, the history of physical or sexual abuse in childhood is much more common in women with psychogenic seizures than with men. And some of these articles have remarked that men with psychogenic seizures can have more convulsive seizures, they tend to have more violent seizures. And we haven't made a study of this, but my impression is that at least some men with psychogenic seizures will tend to act out in a more violent way than we typically associate with women. However, I have to tell you that in our veteran population, we have many men, who have really psychogenic fugues as their presentation of psychogenic seizures, where they go into these prolonged fugue states, which can last for hours at a time, and they have no movements at all. So I think the presentation is highly variable in both men and women. But I agree with you. Some men with psychogenic seizures have a particularly violent pattern.
All right, I want to take the time to thank Dr. Slinsky for his time in presenting this PowerPoint and giving us all the information. We will be meeting again as a group and also be planning our next audio call within the next couple of months. I hope everybody can join us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.